this evening. It's really wonderful to have such a great showing for tonight's talk. Just a few pointers. The restrooms are in the back of Atherton. If you need to go, there's also a water fountain. And if you did park in the parking lot, make sure you have your member sticker on your car. Otherwise, it is $3 to park in the evening programs. Getting those details out of the way, just want to welcome you all here and introduce Dr. Pat Kirch. Many of you have seen him share talks about his books, and tonight is special because he has a new book out. It's a continuation of the research on Kaikinui, but of course this is about Heiau. And so it should be a very interesting talk. I'm sure you all will enjoy it. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce Dr. Pat Kirch.
Aloha mai kākou. It's lovely to see so many people come out this evening. As Kelly said, I'm going to talk tonight about basically the content of this new book that was published this summer by University of Hawaii Press. It's the second book I've written about my research in Kaikinui on Maui, which has occupied my time for, I don't know, almost 25 years now, I think. This one in particular focuses on the subject of the temple sites. So, Heiau, I think everybody probably in this room, he wouldn't be here, knows or has some idea of what a Heiau is. It's a ritual place, a place of prayer, a place of sacrifice. The origin of the word is quite interesting and kind of actually unknown, because almost everywhere else in Polynesia, the word for this kind of a place is marae. And so Heiau is a uniquely Hawaiian term for these places of prayer and sacrifice and offering. It may derive, one suggestion is that it derives from the word hai, meaning to sacrifice, and in fact, if you go to the Pukui Albert Dictionary, Heiau is given as a variant spelling of Heiau. So that seems to make sense. Now, Hawaiian archaeology, when it began getting going in the early 20th century, particularly here at the Bishop Museum with this man, John F. G. Stokes, who worked here, really did focus on the study of Heiau. Heiau were pretty much the be-all and end-all, actually, of Hawaiian archaeology for many years. And Stokes himself went to the Big Island and to Molokai and did quite detailed studies of Heiau sites. It's one of his plans there, one of his maps. Did very careful maps, drawings, and so on. But in the early years, early 20th century into the 20s, 30s, 40s, there was no excavation and no painting of Heiau. It was all surface survey, all surface mapping. It was before any radiocarbon dating had been developed, and anything was worth getting into the ground. So it was all surface material. And another very important source of information about Heiau comes from Kanaka Maoli, Native Hawaiian scholars themselves, such as David Malo and Samuel Kamakau, Kapalino, and others, who provide a great deal of information about Heiau, about the structures, about the individual houses and accoutrements and so on of temples, and the practices, the rituals that were performed on them. And without that information, we would have much less to go on in terms of trying to understand and interpret these structures. So I'm going to mention that. However, when radiocarbon dating was invented around 1947-48, then Kenneth Emery here at the Bishop Museum then began to excavate habitation sites, rock shelter sites, and so on in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, the study of Heiau kind of dropped back again. And all the emphasis went on sites that contained lots of artifacts, portable artifacts, which, especially fish hooks and adzes and so on, which Emery and then Yoshi Sonoto and others thought were important for establishing chronology and tracing the origins of the Hawaiians back into deeper into South Polynesia and so on. So Heiau kind of began to take a back seat. And this has been the case for the most part throughout the last 40, 50 years. It's interesting. There have been a few exceptions to this. I'll mention work of Michael Kolb on Maui, for example, Edna Brad did some work with Mokaha Valley. But in general, people stop looking at hail, so it's kind of odd. One of the aims we have with this book is to put hail back at the center of Hawaiian archaeology. They're obviously critical to understanding Hawaiian culture and society. So this study I'll be talking about tonight, this book, focuses just on two ancient Mokuhr districts within Maui, the island of Maui, the Moku of Kahikinui and the Moku of Kaupo. And one of the reasons they're so interesting is that, I know some of you have been there, these are very undeveloped areas. They never really had plantation agriculture, they're ranching areas, no widespread bulldozing or destruction of sites. So they're some of the few areas in the islands where we can look at entire landscapes, archaeological landscapes. We find many hail of all sizes and shapes, and also look at the relation of hail to the entire settlement pattern. So I've been working in Kahikinui and Kaupo since 1995, recording more than 3,800 archaeological sites of all sizes. Some are pretty small, some are very big. But around 2003, I began collaborating with an archaeoastronomer named Clive Ruggles. I wish he could be here tonight. He's a co-author of the book. It's a very excitable book. So, anyway, so it'd be really fun if he were here tonight because it'd be a real dog and pony show, but he's not here, but that's Clive. A few of you met him, you know Clive. So, but I want to credit him fully. It's been a collaboration. Clive has a PhD in archaeology, but he has another PhD in astrophysics. He's one of these, you know, incredibly brilliant. And he knows his astronomy and all that. And so it's a collaboration between myself, and I really know Hawaiian archaeology, but he really knows archaeoastronomy and the methods. So we couldn't have done it except together. It's a true collaboration. So just a brief introduction to the area, those of you not familiar with the two Moku here. I've outlined them basically. Southeast Maui, Kahikinui, Kaupo. Kahikinui, by the way, the name is very interesting because, whoa, I guess it's sideways. Oh. I'm afraid to speak. Okay. What is that? Yeah, okay. Kahikinui, as I was saying, the name means Great Tahiti. And the island of Maui is shaped like the island of Tahiti. And some of you have been to Tahiti, you know the big part of Tahiti is Kahikinui. The small part is Tahiti. I think when voyagers came up from the South Pacific at one point and they saw this and they recognized the shape, Polynesians transferred the names of islands and places over and over again. So Kahikinui was clearly named for that resemblance to Tahiti in the South Pacific. But the landscape here, as you can see in the slide, it's very dry arid. It's in the rain shadow of Halakalā. And it's a marvel in some respects that people actually occupied it so densely, primarily in the upland zone because the coast is really too arid for any agriculture. But in the uplands, they could grow sweet potato, and it was quite heavily populated. When we turn to Kaupo, the adjacent Moku, it's a little bit more fertile. There's more rainfall. You get rain comes down out of Kaupo Gap, which you see there on that slide. And so actually we know that the populations of the two areas were rather different. Kahikinui, in 1832, when the first census was made, had about 400 some people, whereas Kaupo had about 3,000. So there's a big difference in population density. Both areas are relatively dry and leeward landscapes, or what the line is called the Ainamalo, the dry lands, where sweet potato was really important. Now, hail were first recorded throughout both of these Moku in 1929 by a Bishop Museum survey run by J. Winslow Walker, this guy who came from the mainland museum. A number of these surveys in the 20s and 30s. He spent a few months on horseback and just a few days. He went on all of these Maui, but he rode through Kahikinui and Kaupo, asking local people why this thing is doing this, asking people for information they knew about sites, primarily hail, and recording them. He made maps of some sites. They're not terribly accurate. Others he just described briefly in a few sentences. But that was the first information regarding hail in this area. IT guy, what am I? What is that? What is that?
Okay, try this.
Let me just hang and hold it and see how it works. Okay, so Rosemary Walker, 1929. His study was never published. It's a manuscript in the Bishop Museum archive, although his information was later included and synthesized in Elspeth Sterling's Sites of Mali, if any of you are familiar with that. Peter Mark's archaeological work in Kahiki Nui was in 1966, when, again, the museum started a sediment pattern survey. This was something new in the 60s, not just looking at big sites like now, but looking at entire landscapes. And he sent a Bishop Museum team out under the direction of Peter Chapman. And there was a young high school, Peterhof student named Pat Kirk, who was on that team. That's me there. And you know, Sites of Mali. This is Elspeth Sterling, who wrote that. This is Peter Chapman. And I know many of you knew Pila Kikuchi, who was currently your archaeologist at Fort Lee for many, many years. And we were all members of this team. So we visited some Walker sites, and we found a few others and not many sites. And then nothing happened for a long, long time. And Peter's work, again, was never published. By 1995, I was then at joined the faculty at Berkeley, and I wanted to get into some archaeology out in Hawaii again after some years of working in the South Pacific. And so I said, well, we should go back to Kahiki Nui, where we had all this data from 66 and so on. And so I began a project there. I didn't expect it to last more than two decades, but it did. And so out of this has come this study of 78 hair, among other things. We also had a lot of work on house sites, which will be another book someday, I hope, but right now it's just hair. So that's a little bit of historical background. This map shows each dot is a hair site in our book. And in some cases, there's a couple of dots on top of dots. Now, where there are areas where there are dots, it doesn't mean there are no hair, because we haven't surveyed everything. We surveyed, I think, 12 square kilometers of Kahiki Nui, but there's about as much area still for our next generation to go and study. So that, you know, this area here, for example, has never been intensively surveyed, nor has this one in here, nor has some of this in here. So don't look at that pattern and say, oh, there's some significant clustering. It's just where our archaeologists have been able to cover. Okay, there's the book. Briefly mention some of the field methods that we used in this study. The habit's very basic. When you go out there with your birds and you tromp over the lawn when you find these sites and record them. And one way we're talking about is the orientations of sites. And so for that, the basic survey weapons, magnetic compass and a thermometer for altitude, that's cloud levels, that's surveying. That's the most basic method. But when you really want to start getting accurate information about the orientation of sites, magnetic compass lets you down. Because of that, we have this volcanic terrain, and you often get magnetite in dike formations under the ground. That will swing your compass needle, depending on where you are. It can swing at 15, 20 degrees, actually. Not always, but it can. So when we want to look really accurately at the orientations, and this is where Clive comes in, we do a theodolite survey. That's the same kind of instrument you see on the highway or surveyors are, you know, working. But Clive has a little thing that the highway surveyors never use. See that eyepiece there? It's a right angle eyepiece, and it's shaded to enable them to look at the sun. Okay? So when we set up on a site, he does sun sites and we time them. And then that data fed into a computer program. It's basically using the old method of celestial navigation. It's what a navigator would have done in the old days with the theodolite. The sextant. And now it's all computerized. You feed the data into a computer program. It's going to be ephemeris. So what that does, it allows Clive and his site to get exactly true north. And we don't worry about magnetic. We're doing these precise surveys. Then we take a bunch of point readings around the rails, or sort of the rails related, and we can get our exact orientations. without me on the compass. Now, when I'm putting on fashion, I like to map with old optical instruments. The Wallace Avery program was made about 1943, and I still use it. It's called a plan time on Aladdin. Thanks, Kelly. Sorry, I'm spelling it on myself. But you see, it has a piece of paper there, and then that optical instrument, which allows me to map these sites in detail and draw them right there in the field. That's the key thing. I can draw all the stones and all the detail. Unfortunately, no digital instrument has yet been invented that allows you to do that. So the plantar reality has never been replaced by a digital instrument. We're barely doing it, so we will really retire. And then another thing that we do in this book, which is new, we collaborated with another colleague down in Australia named Andrew Smith. His name's actually on the cover because it's important enough for them to acknowledge him. He didn't write anything. But he generated these digital horizon profiles. So these are generated from digital topographic or terrain maps of the area. And we give him the coordinates of each AO, and then he generates this profile of what the landscape looks like from that site. And you can see it strips off all the vegetation. So sometimes we can't really see this today because I've got Guajara right in front of you and all this kind of stuff. So, and then I'm going to turn out here, and all of these profiles I'll be showing. There are these lines, okay? There are three sets of lines. And the center line, dot dash, is the equinox, the rising of the sun. And this one is the solstice, which I wonder if sun is on the clive here. That must be the summer. And then winter here, and the zipper, as I like to call it, that's really important. That is the rising position of the Pleiades, the seven sisters, a little star cluster, which the Hawaiians call Makalii, which is very, very important in Hawaiian culture. We'll get into that. So you're going to see those on these profiles. Okay, now let me start, just give you an overview about Heiau and Kaikinui. As elsewhere in Hawaii, Heiau vary tremendously in size and configuration. They don't fit into one pattern at all. So we have here, for example, a small platform with two uprights, and the uprights there. I'm going to talk more about this one later. Quite small, fit in this area here. This is a two-part hill, fairly good size. Here, another big platform up against the side of a pool. And if we look at the size ranges, this plot just shows you each dot there is a hill in our sample, and it's going on a logarithmic scale in terms of square meters from 1 to 10,000 square meters. And you see one tiny site, relatively small sites, and then a whole just progression continuously, and then we get five really big sites, okay? So it's quite interesting distribution. Most of the sites in the world are falling between about 60, 70 square meters to maybe 250, 300 square meters. But then we have some really huge ones. Archaeologists have tried for years to create typologies of Heiau with not a lot of success. And we don't claim to have a really great consistent typology either. There's just so much variation in Heiau that it's hard to fit them into categories. But we came up with basically five main kind of types, sort of like, and then one catch-all category of unusual sites. So we have notched enclosures, or a U-shape, elongated double court, platform or terrace, and then a category of shrines. I'll briefly describe these with some examples. The notched enclosures, and this was a term that Winslow Racker came up with, and so we just kept using it. I don't really like the term, but it was already in existence. What it means by notched is if you imagine a square or a rectangle here like this, and you take a notch out of it, you see, that's the notch he's talking about. So that instead of four sides, you got six sides there. But what it really means is that you actually have two chambers or two rooms, okay? So that's what's really significant. It's not the notch. It's the fact that you have this configuration with a larger part and a smaller room attached. And I think that in most cases what's going on is this is a sort of court where a ritual is performed, and this is a more sacred or couple area where offerings are placed. And maybe in some cases we're even roofed over and sacred objects are kept there and so on. I'll talk more about this particular site later. It's a beautiful little site. There's another really interesting, this is the largest up in Tahiti, really local, and it is two-notched adjacent to each other. So we have a smaller notched one here and a larger notched one. And the larger one replicates all of the features of the smaller one, including this very pronounced angle here, which Rob and I have taken to call canoe prow corners. Because it's kind of like the prow of a canoe. And the white pebbles, they don't like that. You know, it's not that some rock wall builders made a cup of coffee. No, they're intentionally making these. And almost always, these canoe prow corners point to the big island. I remember in Hawaii and Maui were very frequently at war with each other. They had been married, but they also were at war. So this may be significant. I think in this case, this is the Oahu temple, and it probably was very efficacious. Prayers that were made there were successful and so on, so they decided to make an even bigger one, copying it exactly. That's my theory, but it's just a theory. And then we have the next category of square or U-shape. There are quite many of these. This one here, you have a square wall, and you have a platform in one corner. This is more complicated, with, again, a raised altar, but two rooms within the enclosure. And then the third category I call elongated double court. And it's kind of like notched, but the bigger the notched tail, and they are more elongated, but the eyes, they do have this offset jog in the wall. Again, what's going on here is with the notch is you have two courts or two areas or rooms that are usually separated on this axis by a slight change in elevation. This will be lower, this is higher. Keep in mind that height throughout all of Polynesia relates to rank and to sacredness, to coupling and so on. So again, we're probably looking at this area being more coupled, more sacred than this. This may be an area where it's quite a big temple where people assemble. The witness rites going on here that the Kahuna would perform. I want to say too that, well, before I forget, one of the things we look at in all these sites, we try to figure out what is what we call the axis of orientation. So here at a particular orientation, just if you compare to the, in a traditional Christian church, when you enter in one of the doors, that's a less sacred. The other place is sacred, but it's less sacred. People enter there, you face the altar, the high altar is the less sacred place. Well, there's an axis of orientation. Here I have the same kind of thing, going from less to greater kapu-ness, if we call it that. So in this case, with the altar up here, the higher elevated court, etc., we'll say the axis of orientation is like this. From this side to this side increasing, and that the hair is meant to face this way. Usually we can make a very strong argument of what the axis of orientation is, although in some cases it can be a little ambiguous. In some cases we're not totally sure whether it's mono direction or right angle tip direction. And this is all explained in horribly detailed stuff in the book. So, I don't know, this book is not like meant for Saturday afternoon read. Some of my books are, but this one is pretty dense. So, and it has two parts to it. The first part is a general analysis, and the second part is a detailed description of all 78 temples. We want to put on the record all of the detail. So everybody else can go back and look at it and argue and sort of. The fourth type it is a terrace or platform here. So here we don't have an enclosing wall, rather we have an elevated platform or terrace. This is one of the really big ones. This is Lua Lua here in Kaupuna. I'll get to more about that later, but it has this, keep it in the wrong, five terrace faces on the east end, stands about 7 meters. It's a very, very impressive site associated with King Ke Kaumike. And then we have this category of small shrines, and many of these, which are down on the coast, are without doubt or fishing shrines. They have a lot of birch growing, which is a marker of being fishing, of being a fishing shrine. Here, all these dots are representing branch corals. So those are the main categories. We have that catch-all. Usually here, stand alone, just one in one place, but there's one real exception to this in Kahikinai. There's an area up in the land section of Kipapa Makaaha that has a cluster of which is almost like a kind of acropolis, since I've come to think of it. And so you have here, an oven house probably for cooking pigs or offerings for animals, a house of a priest, here, and then a big assembly area. And I don't know anything else quite like this in Italy. It's a very, very interesting complex. This is a view of Parliament from the air, like the priest house here, the square heiau, oven house, and there's other ones you can't see in this photo. Okay, now, briefly talk about the chronology of here. So, what we've been able to do in our study is actually put not but many of these here into an actual chronology, something that has not really been done very often in the line heiau research. Marco Kao, who I mentioned briefly before, is one of the few people who before us have worked on heiau in modern times. Did his doctoral dissertation research on heiau in Maui. And he had a series of radiocarbon dates that you see here, each line, each line across being a radiocarbon date with a probability distribution associated with it. These radiocarbon dates are not dates, they're probability distributions. But at the time Carl was working, which is in the early 90s, I think, radiocarbon dating is just before it went through a new kind of revolution with accelerated mass spectrometry dating, which really brought down the error bars on radiocarbon dating tremendously. So we were able to take advantage of that. And I think you can just visually see the difference between this slide and the kind of probability distributions, which are much shorter and tighter than back to that one, than Carl's longer distributions. And so that made us think that the chronology for heiau construction in this area was much shorter than Kopp had believed. But we were able then, even a few years later, to take advantage of a completely new technique, some of you have heard of this, which is like radiocarbon, but it's a different system. It has to do with the uptake of uranium in corals, and the uranium decays to thorium. So it's kind of like carbon 14 decaying to 13, but here we have uranium decaying to thorium. So it may surprise you to learn that the ocean is full of uranium. You can think about that next time you go for a swim, but it is. And corals take up uranium constantly into their skeletons, and over time that decays to thorium, and my geochemist friend at Berkeley, Warren Sharp, can analyze that and give me highly precise dates, much more precise than radiocarbon, sometimes plus or minus 2 years. Okay? So we experimented with this, and you have to take a little piece of core, but you don't have to take very much. We don't have to take a whole piece, we can just extract, you know, like milligrams, and that's enough to date. So we go out, and we just take portable sun, we just take a little piece off the coral, and we get our dates, and these are the sites we've been able to date. Not all air sites have coral, but the ones that do, we've been able to date. I should mention, we don't know exactly why Hawaiians were putting coral on heiau sites. It obviously is some kind of ritual offering, but they were putting them on both on altars, but incorporating into the walls, into the wall fill. So when we get a thing on coral in the wall fill, we got a little bit better at construction. Okay? And so part of that, you see some, and we carefully took sample both corals and others as offerings, but also coming out of ours to make sure we weren't getting a biased sample. And here's the summary of the dates. We had 46 dates, and this is by 50-year age interval. So we have a couple of one really early one, it's interesting. Two in here, one in one. But almost all are concentrated heavily in the period from 1550 to 1700. So this shortened the chronology from what Cold had thought. It's a much later in time. And I think what's really important is another kind of plot of this by sites, is that when you go to the local coral hall, the genealogies of the kings of Norway, right? 1550-1600 is right when P.E. Lani and then Kihara P.E. Lani, his son, consolidate the entire Maui kingdom for the first time into one. And then Kamalala Lalu, the grandson, continues that. So I think what's going on is a period of AR construction associated with the consolidation of the Maui kingdom politically. So here are very, very important places for passing down orders, to the people, and for organizing production of the landscape, all the sweet potato farms, all this sort of stuff. So I think this correlation in time is really important. I'm not saying these sites weren't used later. These are mostly construction dates. So the AR system is being established, and of course continues to be used up until 1819, the end of the Aikato system. Okay, so that's for chronology. Just briefly, we also have done excavations in similar sites, not a lot, and not big excavations that try to be minimally intrusive, but there are some interesting things you find out when you put a test pit into AO, and these are primarily small mid-sized sites that we've worked on. So here's an example of a small half-meter by meter excavation against the wall of a site. Now, one reason to do this is to get charcoal so that you can do radiocarbon dating. But we also came up with these kinds of things. In this case, fish hooks and pieces of fish hooks in the process of manufacture. Why would we find fish hooks in a hail, right? It was kind of surprising when we first came up with this. You think of these are places of prayer, offering. Why are we getting fish hooks? We got manufacturing tools, honestly making fish hooks. And we got evidence of ads fraction, right? These are ads for forms. I mean, not a faking device on these. So in other words, now, these are primarily men's activities, doing male craft activities within the animal. And this is something that's not really been commented on or understood in the past. But when you're going to read, again, the sources like I was mentioning of Manoa Kamakara, of course, you find that there were four couple ties within each lunar month when the men were required to go into the temples, right? And what better time but to do craft activities and so on than when you're in the Heo in one of those four couple ties within the lunar month. And the activities were probably ritualized as well. I mean, you want to evoke the Akua and the Amakua for the production of these things, of the fish hooks. So that kind of makes sense. And you see that there's no separation between economy and religion or ritual in Hawaii. It's all tied together, right? So that was very interesting. And this is another abyssal tool from one of the, okay, so now we get to the orientations and the view shapes, which is really a lot of what the book deals with. And I just want to point this out in the big study that Larry Valori did, Kingship and Sacrifice, really wonderful work on Hawaiian religion. He has this kind of hierarchy, he calls it, of temples, and I just want to mention this, because what people are seeing this reflected as well, as there was a hierarchy of gods from Ku, Lono, Kane. There's also this hierarchy of temples from the Ruakili or Ra temple of Kuru. Now, for most of the temples being agricultural, for the increase of fertility or some for rain, and Kane and Kanawa also have their hair, Ra, But Cornell, I guess I forget, isn't just a war god of Valkyrie. It's also an important god at the small fishing shrines at the Coral. Okay. So I just wanted to draw your attention to this. Now, when I started, maybe around late 1990s, compiling some data on my AL surveys, before I joined up with Coral Rebels, I had enough data, I had about 40, I think it says that, AL sites that I had to turn my orientation on. So I sat there and I plotted the load on a diagram, to see here. Now, John Stokes had said a long time ago that AL had no consistent orientations. Everybody believed him, and nobody ever thought to test it. And even California used to tell me, no, AL, they just orient with the topography, they don't know which way, they have no real orientation. Well, when I plotted my data, it sure didn't look like that. This is like, a compass diagram, and each ring going out is outside. So I was getting a real cluster here, east island, and I got some over northeast and north. I had one little guy down here that was the opposite direction. I couldn't figure that out. But so I published an article on this, and I proposed that these orientations, the three main clusters, corresponded to three main gods. And I think I have the slides. Yeah, cool. So I have here the four main gods of Hawaii, Kung, Kane, Lono, and Kalawara. But we talked probably about the first three there. So who has orientations we know, particularly to high, mountains, et cetera. In our area working at, these temples are in the north, but that's because the north is Haleakalā, the summit of Haleakalā. So it's not really north that's important, I think. It's the mountain summit, okay? A whole lot of temples, as you see here, the biggest number are oriented to the east. And those ones, I argue, are associated with Kane, who clearly is oriented with the east, with the rising sun, how we chant up the sun, chanting to Kane, the path of the sun across the sky is the great shining path of Kane, etc. I don't think anybody would question the association of Kane with the sun. But Lono is associated with the Makahiki, and the Makahiki is determined by the equinoctial rising of the Pleiades of Makahiki, okay? The first visibility at sunset of Makahiki, which was around late November in the late 1700s. And so we have this other cluster that's oriented to the northeast, often very precisely to the rising of Makahiki. And I think those temples may be temples dedicated to Lono. It's not to say that some temples might not have multiple gods also. It's entirely possible. So, if we look at this one, for example, or these two, this kip one, it's these walls, this and this and this and this wall, they're all within less than 1 degree precisely oriented to due east. It's quite amazing. And they're exactly parallel. And this one I showed you probably before. This is my actual pencil sketch in my notebook. This guy is running north, south, east, west, exactly. But we think the orientation that's important is this way, that this being a sitting slab for a priest, and I'm going to show you the vision, but if not right now, in a minute, you'll see why I think it's oriented to the east. Here's one that's oriented to the rising of Mount Kaneki, Kip 70, whatever it is. Up there at Hale Ridge, it's dead on to Makahiki as well. Here's one that's a north oriented. The north is this way, the altar's here. And many of these north facing here, by the way, they're not exactly true north. Like I said, they're oriented to the mountain, but they are exactly oriented to a big red purple cinder cone on the ridge line of Haleakalā. And remember that red is Ku's color as well. So, increasingly, this is in the book. Of 78 temples now, as from my 40, gives us this distribution pattern, again, very strongly in some north. But you see the spurs, it's not exactly as clean as I had progeny, and all four here in Ripplehead face definitely to the west. Those are interesting as well. But clearly, in each case, we have to look at the particulars of what we think is going on. But for much of this area, there's nothing. And it's not a random scatter. There's no way you can say this is just a random scatter. And this is from Clive's contribution. It's actually, it gives us a curvy ground. But these are showing again the orientations of how he's got them lined up to what possible astronomical phenomena they may be indexing. I can try to explain all that, but it's in the book. 100 days. But here are some of those horizon profiles that I was mentioning. These are certain hail that are located in the Oahu area to the west of the Lower Lauinui Hills, if you're familiar with this landscape. It's a big pool in the middle of Kaiki Nui. And what I just want to show you here is how they seem to be using the pool. That's where this is all Makalii rising. It would be easy to remember on that landscape where you've tracked it. That's where Makalii, when it hits this point, this is where we're looking, you see. So what I think is they are choosing locations for what we call the view shed, right, for the view that you see from that site, because the landscape, like this one, you know, it's great. I mean, you've got this rising off the top of this pole, rising off the top of this pole. Or this one, you know, in the valley between them, same thing here. So these view sheds, I think, are very important. And so why is Makalii so important? Because the Hawaiian calendar was a lunar calendar, right? And the Hawaiian calendar, of course, was essential in controlling planting and fishing and all these economic activities. Now, if you have a lunar calendar and you don't have some means to calibrate that to the solar year, you'll very quickly get out of sync, right? Because there's a difference between 12 lunations and a solar year. So what you have to do, and the Polynesians figured this out even before they came to Hawaii, this is all through Polynesia, they used usually Pleiades rising after Polynesia, but in some cases, like Longo Island, they also used the solstice. The solstice positions, to recalibrate every year. So when you see that plane is rising, then you have a very short little intercalated 13th month, and then you begin your lunar calendar properly again with the first lunar month. So it's absolutely essential to keep the calendar in sync. And in a place like Kaiki Nui, these are rainfall graphs for months in two places in Kaiki Nui, and you can see that there's this very dry period in between. So you've got to have your sweet potato planting calibrated really quite precisely to when you know the winter, the cooler rains are going to come, have your fields prepared, and so on. So this calendar is essential. Okay, last part of this talk, I'm still okay on time. I'm going to quickly run you through just some selected sites, show you them and why they're interesting. So this one I've already seen, I think, twice or three times until I like it a lot. It's very small. I think between me and this table here, you look at the scale. So you've got this sort of open crack and then this small one. There's a sister chamber here that I think probably contained either wooden image or some kind of ritual paraphernalia. It has a defined entryway with a big pahoehoe slab. And then another big pahoehoe slab, which is certainly a seating place for the priest, for the kahuna. I put his map on that. And hopefully I have here, yes. So when you're sitting, and I took the lower slide, seated on that pahoehoe slab, this is the view you would see. And there's the horizon profile. Again, look, you know, here, this is an east-oriented, we believe. So what's important is probably the equinox here rising out of that valley, but you also, you know, have this great landscape markers for the two solstices in for Makalii. It may be interesting that this seems to be a position stone purposely, you see, would match that equinox rising. Another thing is just to the east of this little temple, a short distance, maybe 20 feet, is a little stream that is normally dry but would flow with times of chronostorm, and it leads down to a little Kipupo, that's a nice soil, it's probably a good planting area. So again, remember, yeast, kane, flowing water. Kane is the god of flowing waters, right? This one, one of the few that we actually have a name for that was given to Walker, although I think it's probably just the name of the place, Kohoropapa, where there's the lower slide. It's really big. Walker was part of it actually on Mulukini, a hill of human sacrifice. It may have been. It's quite large. But that is around to the east. And here's the view. This one's fantastic. He's standing on the corner. Here's the rail, right up to the pole of the Lower Hills. And, you know, your equinox sun would rise right up over the pole. It's quite dramatic to see that. This is a very small temple, agricultural temple. Again, you see the solstice and the rising coming up here, right out of that valley between the pool. And this one, I don't know which is my favorite, right? I have lots of favorites, but it has to be one of my favorites. It's down in a lava depression, and really rough terrain in the Lemmas. Not any place that people would cultivate. Not like this, near the coast. It's a notch enclosure, so you can see there's the smaller chamber here, the larger court. Clive's got his instrument there. And at first, because the smaller chamber, this one we thought maybe it was west away, but it didn't make any sense because of this big ridge and you can't see anything in that direction. So when we went back and we re-surveyed, we began looking, well, here's a plan of it. Again, the smaller chamber and the court. And for someone seated right in front of the smaller court, probably the altar area, I began looking at what the views were in this direction. And so we said, look at that. There's two barracos here. And when Clive figured out his daylight, that's the rising position of Makali'i, right there. But then it's better, because we went over, so right there, we just, first, like, look at that, those natural rocks are falling. Whenever we climb, those natural rocks, they've been set in position, okay? I think, actually, this one is natural, but there's three here that are set. So this is a device, an actual device for observing, and there's a detailed close-up. This is our face, too, by the way, so. But those are not really rising. It's pretty, kind of gives me a chicken skin talking about it, actually. This is Kip 77, which is one again, I say, Makali'i oriented, and there's a plan of it. Yeah, I think we have that. No, I'm sorry, I don't have the issue, but anyway, it's Makali'i. This one I showed right at the beginning of the talk, but this would be a very platform type with two uprights, remember? And there's a lava ridge running here. That's natural, this is constructed. But I think I have the picture, So you're sitting on the platform, here's the two uprights framing this, and if you can look it out here, there's a real pointed natural barraco here. Doesn't show too many slides. It's very pointed when you're sitting there. The peak of it just pushes the far ridgeline of Halakala. That's exactly the rising position of Makali'i. So it was built, I think, to incorporate that view shape. Act 30. This one, this is the plan, of what I just showed you. This is a plan of it. Here's the platform, the uprights. And interesting, one of these, this is like a lower attached terrace, probably for participants who are not the kohanim themselves, but to sit and observe and witness the rituals. One of them have this. Set 1 to Kapil, set 411. This is one we discovered. Nobody had recorded this one. I didn't know of it. It seems to be a double, I think an older one. I can't really see it in here, but older notch that's going down. And I think some of the cells were taken to make this big U shape. It has a fantastic view out over the field system of Kaupo and in the other direction up to the Kaupo Gap. And it's pointing directly at that's high summit, very summit of Halakala, the peak of Maui, of East Maui. This is the plan map of it. And then we get to, almost finished here. World War I. Anybody been there? Some of you have probably seen it. It was recently cleared off of all the vegetation by hard work of community group there. You can see the size of all of the three vehicles parked there, three SUVs. Well, this one we know something about. In Kamakawa's Running Chiefs of Hawaii, he discusses this and mentions that it was dedicated by Kekaliko. But almost certainly that was a rebuilding. It's very much older. It was back in time, but Kekaliko definitely is associated with this. And the last rituals that we know were performed there were by Kamehameha's high priest, Kamehameha, who took a legal there. He's fairly young. Boy, but Kamehameha took Lihalihu around to many of the main temples that had been rededicated after Kamehameha conquered Maui. So they went to this one as well. It's this big terraced hill with these prominent facings, five terraces here, descending down. There's a big one of Rainui Gulch, the ones here. It is a lakini for sure, associated with the king, but here's my map and a plan of it. What's particularly interesting is that it is oriented absolutely directly at Maka'i'i Rising. Okay? So this is the viewshed from it. It's facing, with this high terrace, is all facing in that direction. So really interesting Lakini, but more associated facing to the east. Which, when you figure, all of Kaupo is economically depending on a huge sweet material production system, you know, it makes a lot of sense, right? Excuse me. And then nearby, just a little bit more quiet of that, we have another big temple, also said by Kamakawa to be associated with Kekaliko, called Popoivi. And this is a huge, complicated thing that unfortunately had some post-contact alterations. So this, I keep doing that, this wall that I trace here is probably a 19th century pig wall enclosure. So you got to take that off in your mind, and then we have this big massive this, okay, and a dividing terrace that is higher than this, and then some really interesting stuff here, including a chamber in the northeast corner that may have been for holding images. It can be very complicated. Carl worked on the site and thought that it is probably both a temple and the royal residence of the king, and he may well be correct in that. And it has a great pearl corner. The face is directly to Waipio Valley, and as you know, Kekaliko was attempted to actually conquer Hawaii. He didn't succeed. But I've sat out there myself, I kind of visualized him sitting there and looking at Waipio and contemplating, you know, his attempted invasion. The last ones I want to mention, Kohea down in near Nu'u, the place called Kohea, another really interesting site, built out of rough lava. So walls are collapsing because it doesn't hold together too well. You can see the size of it. My friend John holding the surveying rod. It is a big U shape like this. It has a whole lot of platforms inside that I think are post-contact graves. Obviously, we're dreaming of trying to open them, but I think that's what they are. Foundation of a large house here. But this is leg that goes up like this, and this is due north. It's interesting. But you can see it's not a right angle. So the orientation, which is clearly this way, the altar, is one that does not fit any of our normal patterns. And here's a drawing again next to that very high altar. The altar is like 3 meters high. When you stand in the western end and you look down the court at the altar, and this is a projection of stars, you know, I mean, it shows like a light sky, but it'll be at night. This star, Sirius, when you trace its rising, would rise right out of that center of the altar. And Sirius is really important in Hawaiian astronomy, primarily because it's known as the canoe guiding star, but that direction that we're facing is not the direction to go to Tahiti. You may end up in Baja eventually if you went that way. Sirius has another name, and when I realized that, I think that may be what is going on here. So it's also called Lo'ake Kane, procure the man, as in human sacrifice. And this is big enough, this is probably a little key. This L is not referred to in the Mahalo Falcon doesn't mention it, so we really don't know anything else about it. And finally, as my closing to the slide, I have to watch this tonight. This is not a halo, but it fits in the thing we're talking about astronomy and orientation. Some of you know about this. It's a site that I worked on and published it separately in the Journal of the Polynesian Society a few years ago. It's this really unique well, about 30 feet long, very well built, by volcanic anomaly in a place called Halemaua. A lot of people there just think of the notched well. When I first started thinking, I heard about it and I looked and saw it myself. It kind of looks like a gun sight on an old rifle or something. So, and that notch is not where some rocks fell out. It's really nicely constructed, as you can see there. And when you stand here and you look through a notch, what you see highlighted against the horizon is an awful here, stone cave about this high, built in the same style. We were able to find a couple of pieces of branch coral right next to the other one. We dated one. It dates about 1440 AD. That's around the time that I think the last voyages took place between Tahiti and Hawaii. And we know about the tradition of Ra'alei Kahiki, who was the son of Waikina, who he sent Kila later to fetch and came up from Tahiti and lived for a while in Kauai and Oahu. And then ended up at Kahiki Mai, according to the Mo'olelo of Kamakaua and Forerunner, the last place that he stayed. And he said, "This land is too windy. I don't like it here. And if you've been to Kahiki Mai, you know it is pretty windy out there." And it said that Ra'alei Kahiki left from there to Kahuawa and then voyaged on Ra'alei Kahiki and never to return. Now, I can't prove it, but I have this very strong feeling that this has something to do with Ra'alei Kahiki and indicated the way to Kahiki. The old Robin Palakea from Kaupua and his family came from Kahiki Mai told me about this site, similar book on Kauai and Kahiko, if you want to read about it. And he told me, he said, he's on the set, that is a parallel now, right? And he said to me, still as his day, we're standing there looking down at it from the old church roads up on the highway. And he said, "Parallel now, you now know," he had a hand gesture. He said, "You now know, go Kahiki." Okay. And this picture, I'm going to close with this picture. You can see it. A couple of chat brother took this not very long ago and shared it with me. Yeah, he went down at night, beautiful, and so he lit the wall and then took the picture. So what you see, we have it here in this one. That's the Southern Cross. Well, he's got it just beautifully. So when the Southern Cross goes through, it goes like this. The light is standing upright, so its axis is upright. It's pointing right through that notch. And the Southern Cross is the voyaging constellation to Kahiki. Okay? We've got time for a few questions, I think. And then if anybody wants, I can sign books over at the table here after. Yes. Okay. Yeah, I'm making a point. Harry's pointing out that they, and you can see it on those diagrams, so the solstice, winter solstice and the Pleiades rising are essentially the same. At least at this time, maybe 1600 they are. I think they diverge as you go back in time, but I'm not the astronomer. We need Clive here. But yeah, no, good question. Why not just use the sun? I think they're using both myself. But we do, if you look comparatively across Polynesian cultures, it's the Pleiades almost everywhere that's being used. So I guess it goes back in time 3,000 years or more. And there's something magical, you know, about the Pleiades. Polynesian cultures are not the only cultures that use Pleiades for this way. It's all around the world they use it. And to me, they're magical, you know, stars, because when you when you look at them, you know, they're not very bright, but if you look away slightly in your eye, they become bright, you know. So they have this magical character to them. So I don't know. I mean, I can't explain it. But they could use either. We do know in Mandarava, where I've worked, they were using the solstice. They explicitly said they were using the solstice. That's the one place in Polynesia we know that. And, but I do think they're probably using both.
The first slide had a picture, and you didn't identify it.
Probably in the book, I think, maybe. That's Laura Hale. That's what you're looking at. That's the stars.
Thanks, Pat. You mentioned at a Hale where you found ads and fish hooks and things, and you talked about spirituality and economy, I think the terms were. That reminded me, and this is going to be very controversial probably, about Mauna Kea and some people that don't support the spirituality or the claim that the mountain is spiritual. They say, well, look, we find all these ads quarries. It was just, that's not spiritual. And so that caught my attention about spirituality and the economy. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, sure. I'll say something specifically about Mauna Kea. I'm not going to take a position about it. But I will say something about archaeology. And so Mauna Kea has this huge ads quarry. That's mostly probably now the biggest ads quarry, I think, in Polynesia, which was producing thousands of ads over several hundred years. But right in the quarry are multiple shrines, okay? And the mountain itself, this is the work of Pat McCoy and others, had recorded, I believe it's 233 shrines dotted all over the mountain. So there's definite archaeological evidence of ritual practice on the mountain and on the quarry. There's only a point about what I said, I think, was that in Hawaiian society and culture, economically, what we think of as utilitarian activities were not separate from spiritual or ritual. Everything had a ritual context, right? So the production of the ads makers had their own deities. They performed prayers and offerings while making ads. I think you cannot separate. It's a Western idea that you have an economy and then you have your religion. You know, on Sunday you go to church, and then from Monday to, you know, Saturday you break the economy. I mean, you know, and they didn't have that separation. Most traditional cultures didn't have that separation. So that's what I was alluding to. And so, you know, the evidence I showed you there. It's not just one site, several sites that we did these little test excavations, and we got fish hooks and adzes and so on. And in fact, I should mention this. Another study that we did in Kaikinui was to look at these little flakes that come off adzes, you know, who debitage. We can now analyze geochemically the composition of those quite precisely, and we can trace them to individual quarries. So we can tell you whether something's coming from the Mauna Kea quarry. We analyzed, I think, about 370 of those little flakes from various sites in Kaikinui, and we did pick up Mauna Kea flakes, so we know Mauna Kea adzes were coming into Kaikinui. Most of the Mauna Kea flakes were out of these Tusk and Heiau sites, okay? So as the high quality of the soil is coming in through, again, a ritualized kind of context, right? Probably through the kahuna, and probably, you know, when the men are coming in again, gathering to work in those kapu nights, that's when these really good quality adzes are being used for sure.
Well, Dr. Kirk, I'm so excited to have you here this evening, and I'm so excited that you're back home with us. So thank you to the Bishop Museum for having this. Quick question. You had mentioned in the cluster of Heiau that there was a priest's house, and I'm just wondering what identified that as a priest's house.
Yeah, that's a really interesting site. We published a separate article on it a few years back. I can share it with you if you're interested. I think it's probably the only priest's house that has ever been identified archaeologically. Well, when we mapped that complex, where it stood out, it was a different kind of site. It didn't look like a house, it didn't look like a house, but you know, we had to determine that. So my excavator, David, has a fireplace in it, it's got cooking in there, it has all kinds of house stuff, shellfish, you know, from meals and everything. It's clearly a house. But it had some really special things in it, too. It had a lot of bark, interestingly. It had pig, which is surprising, but the particular bones were cuts that we know from the, you know, ethno-historic sources were special to priests. It had a little piece of, you know, we go into lava tubes, and the big one, you know those drips? You know those lava drips? It had one of those, right? And they either had to come out of a cave into like a lava, or from the big island, because lava tubes, when they weather in the old islands, it doesn't last. So one of these Kahuna islands had gone into a lava tube somewhere during that ritual practice, taking this little piece. There was a very fine adze, which I think, you know, beautiful looking, probably for carving, like carving ki'i or something like that. And the other thing I remember was there was a little cache in just a small corner on the back of the house near the hearth of about 200 but equal number of black and white little pebbles. And my initial thought was kumene, right? But then I was reading in Kamakura, those kind of pebbles were also used in diagnosis of kumene with the arrow, placing them on the body, and apparently they allowed them to diagnose certain kinds of disease and so on. So they're probably, because often together, they're probably in a little bag, a little woven bag, which decomposed, but we, you know, found that those put together. So, yeah, anybody interested, we published all of the findings on that, and I can share that with anyone who's interested. Kelly, you can choose who.
Aloha. Thank you, Noku. It's my first time to visit this museum. I'm from the Kingdom of Maui, born and raised. When I was a little girl, my mama took me to this place. My mama, my grandma. I'm from this Ahupua'a. When I was a little girl, my mama took me to this place. And one of the things that I've seen that you can see, when I seen as a little girl when I went out with my mama, my grandma, and my uncles, was they showed me cows that had graveyards, that had Evie bones. But I noticed none is mentioned in your book about it. And another thing that when I went even to Nu'u, the heiaus there, what they had was the petroglyphs. And I don't see that mentioned in here. So I just wanted to know if you can see, if you've seen those, that you bring memory back to me. Because just being here, you make me feel like I'm back home again. Thank you. Ew.
There definitely are EV barrels. I think I can, I'm not talking about that tonight. But we have seen them, and we always leave them alone, respectfully. There are also petroglyphs, as you know, and we found some clusters that I think had never been recorded before in a published article on the petroglyphs. If you're interested, happy to share that. They are mostly in clusters near stream beds, which I think is really interesting. They may be marking family water sources, is my suspicion.
Can you comment on the cairns? I think you called them the cairns in Loa. There's 14 or so cairns, and what you think they, how they were structured with poles or flags?
Yeah, there are. I don't know what exactly the function is. Around the eastern, what they would say, the eastern edge and the bit to the Mackay side as well, right on the lip of the terrace, there are these cairns or abu, or sort of piles of stone. And so when you're looking at the hill from below, it almost looks like a crenellated kind of medieval fortress sort of thing. One possibility, I think I mentioned to you when we were out there, is that those may have been to support poles, each one, you know, because if you had a pole, you'd want to put the hookers around it to hold it in place. With streamers, a couple of streamers, and they were you know, early descriptions of their drawings of how to have that sort of thing. It's a real possibility, but I don't know for sure.
This is regarding the numbers of hangouts that you found in both Kahikimune and Kapo. Have you been able to discern any correlation between the population that you know of and the numbers of hangouts, or is there any significance in Kahikimune per se that would indicate the need for more hangouts or anything like that?
I don't think Kahikimune has necessarily any more or less hangouts than anywhere else. It's just that because this whole Moku, this whole district, has never really been disturbed and developed other than by cattle ranching, we're able to see what's on the landscape. The problem is in so many other parts of Hawaii, there's been so much destruction, you know, particularly plantation. We tend to forget now because plantations are all gone. But, you know, when I was a kid, the only apple was growing sugarcane and then pineapple up in the central plateau. So, you know, huge parts of the landscape on essentially every island. But the ranching is much less, you know, destructive. People do knock over stones, but they're not bulldozing. Well, sometimes they do for a stone removal, but generally, you know, that's much less destructive. But it's really just because this area is in the stone, so we have to see what's there. So I don't think there's any, you know, more or less, really.
Have you had a chance to do any correlative work in terms of Tahiti popping all that incredible incredible experience on top of wherever I went? It was extraordinary. To any of these larger heiau, is there any association? Because I'm really fascinated. So just thank you tonight. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I worked on a project in the Punahou Valley in Moorea, Tahiti, Dutch Polyu Society Islands, with Jimmy Kuhn. It's quite a big monograph published by Bishop Museum on that. And there are differences from Hawaii, but there are a lot of similarities. And as far as orientations there, the cluster that we worked on, about 14, I think it is, Marae, up in the upper part of Punahou, most of them, I think maybe 11 or so out of those 14, are oriented to a particular pointed peak, not the highest mountain, but a very pointed peak where the cliff in front of it is red. And I was actually told by Ilana Murphy, the information she got from Papa Matarao, who's the old Kupuna there, passed away now, but that peak had very significance because of its red color. I think it was called something Araya, anyway, meaning red. Then in Mangareva, and also, I should mention that we have this site, a platform that clearly was an observatory associated with the solstice, like what Gary was saying, because the missionary in Lavalle reported this, that there was this place, Altituiti, where they observed the solstice and so on. And we went there and we actually found this platform with a big seating stone and did the, you know, the observations. And what the missionary said in the 1830s was that the priest told them that the solstice sun set into the cliff of Alatitea on the island of Angikawitai, which you see from the main island of Mangareva. And when we did the calculation, that's exactly where the solstice sun appears to descend into the cave, which, by the way, was the burial place of two great chiefs of Mangareva.
At the beginning of your lecture, you mentioned three Kamakamawi scholars, Kamakau, Malo, and Kipalino. Did you notice in when you were studying them if they had any major differences on how they determined what kind of use in a cemetery? I mean, there was some so what two say, oh, this is an agricultural heiau, and another one says this is a Hawaiikini or anything like that?
Yeah, I spent a lot of time praying over those and anything else I can find. I have not have the time, and I don't have the linguistic proficiency to get into the newspapers, so somebody really needs to be that. But working from particularly the three you mentioned, all the information in 4-under's collection and so on, this is the other Pamako, you know, in 4-under. There's some interesting, mostly about the terminology. When they call a war different types of hero names for them, and the three authors don't use all the same, there's some overlap in them, but they also have some differences. And it's really hard to know sometimes, what the three are. There's just synonyms and differences. So, but that's something I think really that, scholars, young Kanakamaru scholars, especially who are versed in the foreign language, really should get into and see if they can sort this out more. Yeah, but there are definitely some complexities there. And I don't think that those terms really are referring to architectural types. I think they're referring to functional types or to, different, again, the gods or so on, not to, like, this is square, but this is or whatever. Yeah. Maybe one more and then I can sign some books.
The hills that kind of slope downwards where they're like Manawai Nui particularly, were you able to access like the entire thing to draw out your diagram? And if so, about how long would you say you spent in that area? Like in a particular hill or that one, Manawai Nui, Maka.
The Ra'ala you're talking about?
Is that Ra'ala? The one left of Manawai Nui?
Yes.
Yes. That one.
I think it took a couple of days to do the map of that. I have not surveyed around the hill, but to say, just the hill structure itself. And most of the trails are pretty dense Christmas berry stuff, really hard to see. I do know that it's one case where some of the terrain surrounding that was bulldozed by Copper Ranch many years ago, not by the current owners, but previous for pasture improvement. Right? So the sort of structures that may have been around, and it's certainly the case to the west of it. People drive in now, when it's dry and the grass is dry back, you see it's all been, domes that were dragged at one point. So I don't know. If you're asking about structures that may be around the site, I really can't tell you. But I do know some of it was disturbed or destroyed. But why don't we adjourn for that? You have any sign anybody's books over here? And I'd just like to say mahalo nui loa for coming out this evening.